Yes, so thank you. Thank you to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak. And when I prepared, when I submitted my abstract, I thought I could introduce the arrow of time example that I will focus my talk on as a warm-up example and then go to a deeper or a more conceptual discussion of what's going on. And then when I started to prepare my slides, I decided that that's not going to fit into 40 minutes. So I will focus on what this, what locally, spontaneously generated local information can do to help you with the problem of the arrow of time. And I hope that that will trigger a discussion then to what more you can do with that. So let me, there are many ways to state the problem of the arrow of time. What? One, one is that you don't have slides to talk about it. So, but even without slides, I can state what the problem is. The laws of physics are invariant under time reversal, or at least when you, if in local physics, there is the CPT theorem. And so the laws of physics are invariant under charge conjugation, parity transformation, and time reversal. But the argument, that doesn't really solve the problem of the arrow of time, because if we are here and we define what is a particle, what is an electron, then we take the locally abundant lepton in our chemistry and say that's the electron, but we could equally well call that a positron. That's just a local convention. And similarly with left and right-handed, we look at the neutrino sector that is weakly interacting, and we call one part left hand. We call the chirality that interacts left-handed. But if we were to all reverse that, we could not distinguish the physics from that. But yet we experience time is always moving forward. I experience time moving forward, but I don't. Oh, it's warming up. So that is the very roughly the problem of the arrow of time, or that's one way of describing it. No. So there are also, just as I said, I was picky in how I present the problem of the arrow of time. I'm also just, there are many proposals how to attack the problem of the arrow of time. And some of them go into foundational areas of quantum mechanics. For example, there are proposals that the direction of dynamical collapse theories defines you an arrow of time. But this conference is about information theory, and two proposals that are vaguely related to information theory are the thermodynamic arrow of time. That is, and we already heard that, I'm lying here really, that the second law of thermodynamics says that entropy never decreases, but in a sense that's something that is very universally accepted, and that appears to be true. So this proposal is to put this statement on its head and say that the arrow of time is the direction of increasing entropy, whatever that may mean, however you flesh that out in detail in your model. And I want to contrast that to the proposal that the error of time is due to us having records of the past. So this is, we remember the past because there are records of the past. I mean, when I say we remember, it's the state of our brain, and our brain contains the state of neurotransmitters, and our brain contains information that makes us believe that there is a past, but this could be fossils, history books, records of measurements on a hard drive, all sorts of local information that give that have a very simple, straightforward explanation by the laws of nature, and that there was a past that generated these records. So in that proposal, if you push that, you define the era of time as the direction of generation of complexity, where complexity is an approximate measure for the amount of local records of the past and how much information about the past you can deduce from the available records. And I will argue that, at least in a toy model, this is the fundamental era of time. And what I want to show you at the end is that this is not incompatible with the thermodynamic era of time. If you accept the thermodynamic era of time, yes, for subsystems, yes, there was a question.
Just a quick question. Are you worried at all that this begs the question, it's so simple that the local records are records of the past, so it assumes?
No, I mean, I'm just defining it. They could be records of the future, but if we're, your evolution parameter in your differential equation that is in your mathematical model could point in the opposite direction, but still, if I would live there, if my brain just remembers what happened and I have a hard time predicting, so I have good records of what happened, I remember the talks from yesterday, but I have no, I can't imagine what people after me are going to talk about. I have a rough idea what I want to talk about in next 40, 35 minutes. So I would still experience this, the records of the future, if you want to call them, as past, as in my personal perception. And so I always define the era of time as this direction. That's a good question. When you look at this, and this is also very superficial, this is all part of my motivation, so this is why I'm being rather superficial. If you look at these two proposals, they seem to make opposite use of information, because in the thermodynamic era of time, you have, if you think of entropy as a microentropy of a microcanonical ensemble, then it's the log of the number of microstates that are compatible with your macroscopic parameters. So the direction of increasing entropy is the direction in which you know, in which the your knowledge about nature implies less about the microstate of the past. So you lose detailed information about the microstate of the universe. On the other hand, in the records approach, you define the era of time as where you have more potentially available energy, more potentially available information, local information about the past. These two things are, of course, not incompatible because I'm talking about two different notions of information, but there is one point where they clearly differ is that if you want the thermodynamic era of time, you need to start out with a very special initial condition, it's called the past hypothesis, with a very low entropy initial condition, because if you're close to maximal entropy, you cannot deduce an era of time from the growth of entropy. So that means the thermodynamic proposal does not explain the era of time, it only postulates that there has been a past. And this means that if you want to use that as a solution for the problem of the error of time for the entire universe, then this, then the initial condition for the universe has to be very fine-tuned. In the records approach, it's not clear that you run into such a problem because you would not expect that you have recognizable local records in a generic initial condition for a universe. And if you have a mechanism that dynamically generates them, then you can possibly evade this fine-tuning problem. And this is exactly the objective of my talk. I first want to give you, tell you where I'm coming from, so provide a physical framework, then give you a concrete example for the records approach to the error of time. And then once I have discussed that example in a toy model, I want to show you that at least in that toy model, an error of time that is generated by records that are, by local records that are generated by gravity, that this is not incompatible with the thermodynamic error of time in subsystems that spontaneously emerge in this system. And thereby, I avoid the fine-tuning problem. I can have a generic initial condition, and this will happen. You will have thermodynamic errors of time, all pointing into the same direction as the global gravitational error of time. So the framework that I'm coming from is that physics is about the evolution of relational degrees of freedom. And that's, Lee indicated that yesterday, that has to do with the description of gravity, of general relativity, as the evolution of spatial conformal geometry. But usually when you introduce this idea, is you get, or we hear often an objection that is, well, of course, relational is true. We all believe that there are no extraneous units, no extraneous reference frames to the universe, that we have to define all these objects operationally within the universe. But why do you focus so much on evolution? GR teaches us that physics is about events in space-time, their causal relations, and so on, and proper time distances between them. So this is true for the description of general relativity in terms of evolving space-time geometry, and all I can say is that you can look at the same equations and interpret them differently. And this has been known for 40 years, and that there is a dynamical systems description with a well posed initial value problem for Einstein gravity. But what we added to that is that you can that this dynamical system can be derived from relational first principles in which the local reference frame, so the local coordinate system, and the local scale, the local reference scale, is relational. So it has to be deduced from how matter evolves together with spatial conformal geometry. And this is, so we have, the idea is gravity is described by the evolution of spatial conformal geometry. A priori, there is nothing more in that. It's just a stack of these spatial conformal geometries. But our experience of space-time and the picture of general relativity of space-time comes out when you couple matter degrees of freedom to that. Then matter, if you use a specific kind of matter, they provide then local clocks and rods, and they experience locally the scale and duration that you have in general relativity in a space-time solution. So space-time is just space-time and the causal order, those are all emergent concepts that are just an effective description of how matter evolves together with with conformal geometry. And what is important in that approach is that it disentangles physical from gauge degrees of freedom of gravity. So in a space-time, you have the problem of choosing a foliation of space-time if you want to describe it as a dynamical system, and that is a gauge degree of freedom, and that entangles then the evolution problem, which is how you go from one time slice to the next, with the gauge problem, which is how you choose your slicing. And you cannot, in the covariant description, you can intrinsically not disentangle the two. So instead of spending the rest of my talk introducing in detail the description of Einstein gravity, I give you a toy model that gives you the correct flavor of what I want to do. So this is the Newtonian n-body problem, and here, down here, I will explicitly show it only for the three-body problem. So if I want to implement the relational prerequisite that there is no background structure, so there is no coordinate origin, there are no external frames, there is no reference scale or reference unit time interval extraneous to the dynamical degrees of freedom in the system, then I have to demand that the linear momentum, the angular momentum, and the energy, that they all vanish. Now, on Monday, I was in a quick discussion. I forgot who it was. Yes, you mentioned that. You said yes, but why do you make this assumption? The answer is, I can use a similar description a similar deparametrization to these scale invariant degrees of freedom. So if I have three particles, they trace out a triangle, and these scale invariant degrees of freedom are two angles in the triangle, theta and phi. If any of these are non-zero, then I still have a dynamical system in which a deparametrized dynamical system that involves theta and phi, and involves just theta and phi, and its canonically conjugate momenta. But then I will also have a coupling constant appear in here, in the Hamiltonian, that are in one-to-one relation with the numbers that I put here. So in order for these coupling constants, I have to go to the zero values. And zero is zero in any choice of units. That's what prefers zero over any finite value. So then I have this, and I have a dynamical system that just describes how the angles change, and for the three-body problem, or for the in-body problem, you don't just have two angles, and you have a whole list of angles in the in-body problem. And you have a kinetic term, you have a potential term. The Hamiltonian is the logarithm of the kinetic term over the potential term, where you add to the kinetic term an explicit appearance of the evolution parameter, which is not time. Time will be deduced from the amount of change that you have in here. So you will. So in the three-body problem, in the generic state of the three-body problem, there is no clock and rod. But once, for example, I will come to that soon. Once you get into states where, once you get into a regime where you have a local clock and rod available, you will have a physical time that will be related in a non-trivial way to this evolution parameter. So just to illustrate what I said in formulas and words in pictures, if I look at a generic solution, and this really turns out to be rather generic, I can look at this picture. These are three particles indicated by different colors. And I have a bound system of the green and blue particle here, and they scatter with the red particle. So then there will be some violent interaction. This is, there is not very good resolution in this plot here, but this goes around for a while, and then there is an exchange of particles, so the blue particle will be shot out, and there will be a bound pair of the outcomes in this particular example, the green and red particle. So this description in R6, because I don't have angular momentum, I can suppress three of these spatial dimension, can be expressed in shape space in terms of the two angles that are indicated here and that are indicated in the Hamiltonian there. And it turns out that the configuration space has the topology of a sphere. In the parametrization that I choose, the equilateral triangles are on the poles. So this is the equilateral triangle 1, 2, 3, and this is the flip, the 1, 3, 2 equilateral triangle, if you have distinguishable particles. Then you have this ridge here that is indicated by this yellow area, and those are isosceles triangles, so two of the angles are the same in the triangle. And then on the equator, you have collinear configurations, so where all three particles are in one line. And then the colors that I indicate here are a color plot of the potential that governs the dynamics. And wait, where is it? There. So the potential is, the normalized potential is minimal at the, or has its maximum because the Newton potential is negative, it's an attractive force, at the poles, so for equilateral triangles. And when two particles come very close together while the third particle is very far apart, which is when I'm here, when I'm in this state of the very problem, then I'm getting close to one of the attractors. These blue areas are actually infinitely deep holes. It's just that you run out of colors once you're in mathematics when you plot that. But the generic behavior of the energy zero three body problem, except for a set of measure zero of initial data, goes actually like that. So there will be a region of violent interaction. This is when the shape of the triangle can change arbitrarily, and it goes all over the sphere. But then in both directions in time, eventually it will get trapped in one of the shape will get trapped in one of these holes, and it will spiral down to one of the attractors, and the attractor is that two particles are very close together and the third particle is apart. And so
you could have made it a torus instead of making it a sphere, because to make the radius, the distance from the center be the potential. So those would be basically, you see what I'm saying?
I don't know exactly what you mean, because if I just look at the possible shapes of three distinguishable particles, then the topology of the configuration space is just the topology of
the sphere and push it in on the two sides where the potential is.
Okay. You could visualize it. You could visualize that actually. Yes, that's a way to visualize that, is to have something like this, and have these and have the potential as distance from the origin. So you would have the equilateral triangle here, and then you have this star, and this would be equal potential lines, and then they would go like this, and you see that you have that these are infinitely long arms.
There are three of those, or are there?
Yes, there's three. There's one in on the other side of the.
It wouldn't be a turret, it would be something.
Yes, it's that topology with three holes at the end. So what I described on the three-body problem turns out to be the generic behavior of the energy zero, angular momentum zero embody problem. This is that at late times, the system fragments into subsystems. The centers of masses of these subsystems separate asymptotically linearly while the with Newtonian time, and the subsystem, the expansion of the subsystem in Newtonian time is bounded by t to the 2/3. That has to do with the 3 comes from the dimension of space, and the 2 comes from that you have a quadratic kinetic term. Then the subsystems, these subsystems, they will in general be composed of clusters, which are systems that stay bound for all times, like our solar system, or like the example that I will give in a minute is a Kepler pair. And then, of course, this generic behavior is this behavior. I describe it in this direction of time, but the same thing happens when you trace very far back in time. And this just reflects the time reversal symmetry of the differential equation, of Newton's equation. But what I want to emphasize here is that there is one special point. There is a point where the system has minimal extension. So where the system goes from an overall contracting phase, turns around and goes into an overall expanding phase. And you can, this is one of the oldest results about the embody problem, that for the zero and positive energy embody problem, that this point uniquely exists for all solutions. No, those are not conditions, those are statements about the generic. Okay, so if you have positive energy, what changes is that the subsystems can. It's a very subtle change. They don't have to freeze out like t to the 2/3. They can also freeze out linearly in t, and the reason for that is you can just have outgoing expansion. You can have kinetic energy in expansion, and then you have a configuration that just asymptotically expands homothetically. So this is, but still, even in the positive energy case, generically, for if you have large n and if the specific energy per particle is not too large, you will generate subsystems and clusters. You would still have that. It's just it's not generic anymore. There is a finite volume in phase space now for the. Yes.
If you have scale invariance here, what does it mean to say that one state is smaller than the other?
That has no meaning whatsoever.
Oh, okay.
I'm telling you this story in familiar Newtonian language, and what the true meaning of this here is that there is a time in the middle where the state looks generic, and in both directions in time away from that, it sinks into attractors of the dynamics on shape space. Yes.
Does it give rise to cyclical behavior?
So this is, I said zero energy and positive energy. Negative energy can have cyclic behavior. And it's actually a much richer, a much more complicated theory, the asymptotic behavior of negative energy systems, because that is related to knot invariance on shape space. So how many windings you can have. The first one that was found for the three-body problem, for the negative energy three-body problem, was a figure 8 configuration by Montgomery. This is 3 particles that follow each other in equal distances on the figure 8. And so it goes like this, it goes like that, and this goes like here, and then you see they this turns out to be a stable it's not a stable configuration, but it's generic in the sense that such a figure eight exists for all mass ratios, not just for equal masses, but for perturbations of equal mass ratios. But it needs fine-tuned initial data to have this cyclic behavior, to have the exact cyclic behavior. So now I want to come to the point, these subsystems, and I will discuss a Kepler pair, just two particles that are close together. They provide local clocks and rods and also records of the past, at least their toy model records. So the generic subsystem for late times, and the same is for early times, it approaches a fixed energy with some bound, a fixed angle, say, to with respect to its own mass, center of mass, angular momentum, and a linear motion, not a conserved momentum, but because there can be wiggles on that make the time derivative arbitrarily large. So there can be periodic motion on top of that, but asymptotically linear motion. So if you do not take the derivative, but if you divide by time, you get an asymptotically conserved vector. So in a sense, this model already stores information because it asymptotes the subsystems, stores local information because the subsystems asymptote into fixed energy, fixed angular momentum, fixed inertial motion. So there are more and more bits conserved in these under the dynamics. And by construction, I'm actually lying here when I say conserved bits, because that's actually not, they can arbitrarily flip still. Even the first bit can flip if you have something that is close to a power of 2, for example. But what I mean, but you get the idea that you are in a smaller and smaller range, and you have more and more knowledge about what happens. And this could be used as a measure for locally stored information. And then what I described, you would be tempted to deduce the error of time from the growth of this locally stored information. But the problem with that is that that's a teleological thing. So you can never know whether you are already in this, whether you are already in this regime, and whether you have already preserved enough points. Unless you're in a very special situation, you don't know this teleological quantity. It's like an event horizon in general relativity. You need to know the entire space-time to know where an event horizon is. And we would like something that you can locally use, if you're living in that universe, that you can use to do that. I will give you the measure, which shortly, but let me go back and look. I described the generic subsystem, and now I want to give you a more concrete example that you're really familiar with, is a Kepler pair. And so just two particles that are gravitationally bound, a negative energy subsystem. And these Kepler pairs are abundantly generated from generic initial data for the n-body problem, and they will separate. So the forces that one exerts on that they exert on each other will become negligible at late times. So Kepler's third law will become increasingly accurate. So you will have a stable orbital period, and with that, an emergent local unit of time. You will have an aphelion distance, so closest distance of closest approach between the two particles. That becomes increasingly stable, and you get an emergent local unit of length, and you will have asymptotically a center of mass angular momentum for the subsystem, not for the whole system, and aphelion distance direction, and that describes your local frame of reference. So you have spontaneously emerging in the solution, you have enough structure, even in a Kepler period, even in the simplest possible cluster that you can imagine, you have local units that spontaneously emerge in a local frame of reference that spontaneously emerges, and they become increasingly compatible in the sense that at first there will be still some fluctuations, for example, in the orbital period, because there will be still forces between them, but the forces will become more and more negligible between the different clusters or the rest of the universe. And therefore, this unit of time that I define here locally with my one Kepler pair and this one that is over there, I will need a unit conversion. I will have to convert units between the two. But if the ratio is 3:2 asymptotically, this will be more and more conserved. So I will have a spontaneous emergence of Newtonian space-time simply in terms of these clocks and local clocks and rods and frames of reference that I use to describe the system, that I use to explore my neighborhood in the n-body problem. So now I come to the proposal for what I should do to replace this teleological information, and that is we want something that you can simply deduce from looking at the shape of the n-body problem at a given time, and something that measures or that gives you at least an estimate for how many subsystems have been generated and how pronounced, how well separated they are. And the simplest function that you can do is take the ratio of the root mean square length, so that's the trace of the center of mass, moment of inertia of the whole system, and the mean harmonic length, that's just the 1 over the Newton potential. And take this ratio, that turns out to be precisely the minus the potential that governs the dynamics of the system. And now, before I told you that there is a point, and I look at the, I define this quantity and I call it complexity, because the root mean square length is dominated by large distances in the system. The mean harmonic length is dominated by small distances. So if you have a lot of small distances, which is when subsystems emerge, then this quantity will start to become large compared to this quantity will become large. So when subsystems form and clusters, and as they become increasingly isolated, this quantity starts to increase. And this is a simulation of a thousand bodies. What I indicated here is these lines here are analytic bounds that I can put on the analytic bounds for each solution that I can put on this thing. The crossing point here is the point of minimal extension of the total n-body problem, and it's very close to the point of minimal complexity of the system. And actually, you can by choosing less and less generic initial data, you can shift this a little bit, the point of minimal complexity a little bit away from here, but it is always close to this, and then the complexity will grow with linearly growing lower bounds in both directions away from that point. So that's the proposal for the gravitational error of time, is to take the direction of growing complexity, because that's a prerequisite that you have locally stored information, is that these local subsystems even start to form. And it's a straightforward function on shape space. So if you have that, I made this point already here in this picture. There is a uniquely there's a unique point in the middle between the two asymptotic regions, and a lot of stuff can happen, a lot of messy stuff can happen when you evolve away from that. But the point is that when you look at the n-body problem on shape space, there are attractors of dynamics on shape space. So these attractors distort your initial data. What looks like very generic, like a randomly chosen shape of the n-body problem at the beginning, starts to become very structured as you evolve far forward or far backward in time. So this says you cannot choose arbitrary initial conditions in the far past of your n-body problem. When you choose arbitrary initial conditions, you automatically and you impose them, you're automatically choosing midpoint data. If you choose an arbitrary shape, you're setting yourself in the middle of the, somewhere close to the middle of this plot. You want to say this is the far past, it actually turns out that you're always in the middle for that. But that gives you a scenario now that because of this qualitative time reversal symmetry, you get a scenario in which you choose an arbitrary initial condition, an arbitrary shape for example, for the three-body problem, something here. This will evolve, and eventually it will spiral down into one of these holes of the potential. But then you do the time reverse of that. It does something strange here, but then it goes down. It may go down here or there or in the same hole, and you will end up in a very special initial point. So this point, and I can argue, and this is coming back to your question at the beginning, this happens in both directions of the evolution parameter, but records of the past are generated as you go down in this direction. Records of the past are generated as you go down in that direction. So the experience there of time will always point away from this. There will always be in the direction where you go here or here or here when you go deep down into complexity in this complexity function. So since I'm running out of time, I will not talk about the compatibility with the second law, maybe leave that for the discussion.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes. Yes, finite spaces behave, like we said on Monday, finite spaces behave very differently. Even a finite, even if you have no forces, you have a billiard and periodic boundary conditions, you have ergodic behavior.
My question is, I think that it's finite, but very large. Do you think that you can still save the idea?
There is an additional input here, and that's important if you do Newtonian mechanics, these boundaries at a finite distance, they really spoil this that E equals zero, J equals zero, P equals zero, that gives you a scale invariant. So system, because you have a scale in the system now. You have the extension of the rest of the universe there. that gives you a reference unit. If you want it or not, it's there. It's this periodic behavior. So, of course, if you have initial data that is concentrated, if you concentrate your particles there in a small region, and your torus or whatever topology you make or a three sphere is much larger, so you don't see boundary effects yet. So this is small. This is still true, but the but is that this is no longer generic initial data. This is now the same as what you need for you need a special. Now it becomes a special initial condition, and that's actually the situation is slightly different when you use Einstein gravity and look at gravitational degrees of freedom. There, the clustering still occurs even if you have a finite universe. So it's like the infinite volume, at least in the Newtonian limit, is important.
We also looked into general relativistic space-time, so looking at something behavior.
So,
for instance, as it seems to rely on having very complex dynamics here, so basically
it's a lot harder to identify a simple function, and we still haven't succeeded in identifying a simple function like the complexity function that gives you a good measure for how clustered or how much fine structure you have in your gravitational degrees of freedom. And in general relativity, the phase space, even physical phase space, is still so large that you have to make additional assumptions to get this late-time behavior, to get a unique late-time behavior, because a lot of stuff can happen along the evolution that doesn't happen in the n-body problem. And so, but if you... There are also attractors on the shape space, on the shape space description. There are attractors of conformal three geometries. One of these attractors was found by Fisher and Moncrief, and it's essentially, if you have, they prove it under very technical assumptions, but when you look at why they make these technical assumptions, they're really to establish certain bounds that seem to be not necessary for making genericity arguments. It happens that you get large, that the generic late-time behavior has growing voids of negative curvature and filaments of zero and positive spatial curvature. In spatial slices, as the evolution of the three geometry goes. And that gives you something that looks very similar to these structures.
So in astronomy, you see very many examples of Kepler pairs everywhere. You have never heard of any triplet of objects going to a figure 8.
Yes, because what I said here is this is not stable under perturbations of initial data. It is stable for fixed initial data. It's stable under small changes of the masses, of the mass ratios.
So
a figure 8 is not, you will not see an exact figure 8 in the real world. Pardon me?
Approximately, you also don't see
anything. No, it's also an unstable point of the dynamics. That's true. There are, just to close that, there are so-called central configurations, and they are unstable dynamical attractors. So the system can remain, the embodied system can remain for a very long time in those, and the shape changing forces are extremely small there, but eventually you will get, you will feel the kick and you will fall out of these central configurations again. So,
shape dynamics within general relativity, you foliate space time, and then you invoke another symmetry shape.
Yes, so it's
go together this side, this toy model, and what you
think. The technically the way you derive this Hamiltonian here is through exactly the same deparametrization procedure and identifying a conformal symmetry, in this case a global conformal symmetry, as a dynamic, as a symmetry of this dynamical system, in the same way as you do it in GR. But that's the one sentence answer. There are a lot more steps to flesh this out in detail. And it's also just an analogy. It's a parallel that goes to some extent, but not all the way through. Yes, and that's also true in the shape dynamics description. You just have excitations of the spatial conformal geometry. So spatial conformal geometry means that you don't have spin zero, which would be changes of volume, changes of the trace of metric fluctuation, and also spin one, the longitudinal part that can always be absorbed into doing an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. And so you just have the pure spin two evolving degrees of freedom by that.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again and leave it.